The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. 5,000 years of wisdom on demand. Get your first month for only 99 cents. Visit Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia. The Paranormal Podcast is also brought to you by the Mysteries Cruise. Join me, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and Micah Hanks for paranormal fun on the high seas. This November, check it out at MysteriesCruise.com. That's MysteriesCruise.com. Thanks, Holiday Maker Travel.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you once again. And if you love the show, please, particularly if you're on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, go and subscribe to the show. It's a very simple process. On your phone app, your iPhone app, your iPad app, you just go to the bottom of the page in the podcast app. The podcast app is a little purple tile with a little white figure on it. Click on that. Then you go at the bottom where the little magnifying glass is, search for Paranormal Podcast or Jim Harold, and you click on it. And then if you're not subscribed, it'll give you a button that says subscribe. Hit that button and you're good. I really appreciate it. It helps us tremendously. And we thank you so much. And today is going to be a great show because we have two great guests on two very different topics, but both very interesting ones, I think. First up is Jenny Ashford. She's going to tell us about The Unseen Hand, a new exploration of poltergeist phenomena. And then in part two, a quite different interview, Dr. Joe Gallenberger is going to join us and talk about Heaven is for Healing. And I enjoy having varied topics on the show. You have the spooky and you have the more reflective. And I love kind of mixing it up and having different things for people to listen to. So there's something for everyone in this show. And here it is, the Paranormal Podcast. One of the most interesting areas of the paranormal, I think, is the idea of poltergeists. And, of course, we know that very famous movie from the 1980s, Poltergeist. And I think there's a little bit of feeling like, oh, that's only in movies. Well, take one look at the new book by our guest today, Jenny Ashford, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomenon. You will quickly see that it is not just in the movies that this happens. It continues to happen, and it's very strange indeed, and that's what we're going to talk about today. The book, The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. Jenny Ashford is on the line. She is a horror and paranormal writer. She has several books out, and she's been a guest in the past, and we're so glad to have her back with us. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Why did you decide to do a book on poltergeist?
You know, I kind of got interested in, the paranormal when I wrote my first paranormal nonfiction, which was The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. And the more I kind of wrote about poltergeists and stuff like that, I've always been kind of interested in that because it seems like one of the most plausible paranormal phenomena. So, the more paranormal nonfiction books I wrote, I said, I'd really like to do like kind of an old school collection of cases like William Roll used to do like back in the 70s, because I read those a lot growing up. And I felt like there weren't a ton of those out. Like, I know there's a lot of compilations of ghost stories and legends and things like that. And I thought I'd really like to compile kind of all the poltergeist cases that I can find, like going back as far in history as I can find them, and then kind of, going up to the present day. So that's kind of what got me interested. And I wanted to do kind of like a one-stop shop poltergeist book, poltergeist only, and just kind of cover all the ground that I could discover and research.
And we were talking beforehand, this is a pretty considerably sized book. I mean, you're approaching, I think, 400 pages there. And it's, once you started, just more and more, you start finding more and more cases.
Yeah. I mean, initially, my initial outline, I believe I had 53 cases. But the more I researched, these better known ones, like Enfield and Rosenheim and, things like that, the more I researched the better known cases, the more other ones I kept coming across, and I was like, man, that's a good one. And it's like, I'd never even heard of that. So, you know, I had to keep expanding until it eventually ended up being something like, I believe the end total was like 115 or 120 cases. It was like twice as many as I had initially wanted to put in there, but you know, that's okay. I kind of wanted to cover all the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I love almost kind of like the encyclopedic part of it. That's pretty cool. Now it's interesting how you categorize them here. You have stone throwers, raps, taps, and bangs, flying objects and electric anomalies, water, oil, and blood, pyromaniac poltergeists, ghostly apparitions, violent poltergeists, demonic possession. So I never thought about this, but I guess there are different categories of poltergeists.
Yeah, there are. And it's like, I went back and forth for a long time. Initially, my initial outline, I was actually just going to put them in chronological order. But then I thought, you know, it might be more interesting to kind of roughly categorize them into different, you know, whatever the main manifestation of the outbreak was. And then I kind of wanted it to be like, you know, the kind of the minor ones first. And then I kind of wanted it to build up like to a crescendo, you know, where the most violent ones were at the end. So it was, you know, it was almost kind of like a dramatic buildup. And, you know, it was kind of difficult to approach it that way because a lot of poltergeist cases, you know, even though the main manifestation might have been fire or might have been, you know, rain coming out of the ceiling or what have you, most of the time there were other manifestations as well. So it was kind of, some of the cases were kind of ambiguous, like where I wanted to, you know, categorize them. You know, I don't know how, you know, because it's not really cut and dried. But I tried my best to be kind of like, well, you know, this one had someone pushed down the stairs and their leg was broken, so we'll put that in the violent section or, you know, whatever. But I just thought that it would read better if it was just kind of like a ramping up of, and I put them in chronological order within their sections. But I kind of liked the idea of just categorizing them like by manifestation or by the main part of the manifestation.
So in terms of poltergeist, I mean, how far back, I don't know how much historical research you did, but how far back do reports of this go? I mean, I'm sure it didn't start in 1982 with Steven Spielberg. How far back does this go?
Well, the oldest one I found, and it was only a mention, but the oldest one I found goes all the way back to the first century. And it was actually a mention by Flavius Josephus, who, you know, was a pretty well-known historian at the time. And it was just kind of a mention of sort of like an exorcism, generally. And during the exorcism, apparently a pot across the room flipped itself over, according to Josephus. So that was the oldest one I could find, and that was from the first century. There were some from the sixth century. Obviously, the older they were, you know, the less details there were about it. But I kind of wanted to show, you know, even if there wasn't a great deal of information like still left about these particular cases, I still wanted to put them in there to show how far back these kind of manifestations go and how similar they are to kind of recent ones with all these things moving around and, you know, stones coming down on people's houses and things like that. I mean, that's been reported for at least 1500, 2000 years. And I thought that was really interesting that it really hasn't changed all that much. You know, the modern accounts haven't changed all that much from the old ones.
What are the most common kinds of poltergeists?
The most common ones I found in, you know, almost always, and, you know, there are some exceptions, but almost always they start with noises, and it's almost always banging on the walls or scratching at the walls. And that's, I would say, probably 85% of them start like that. And, you know, then objects start to move. You know, people will see things flying across the room or stones will fall from the ceiling or something like that. Now, in a lot of cases, it seems like that's about as far as it goes. But as the book shows, like the second half of the book shows the ones that went considerably farther than that. You know, object movement is easily the most common thing, but there actually were an alarming amount where the poltergeist started fires, or at least they believed that the poltergeist started fires. There were a few cases that might have been hoaxes or might have been, you know, kids playing pranks. But, you know, and then it'll get to the point where you know, people are getting bit or people are getting pushed down steps or, you know, shoved or other things like that. It's rarer for the manifestations to get to the point where they're hurting people or, you know, killing people. In a couple of cases, a couple of people did die. But, you know, basically things flying around is pretty much reported in almost all of the best known poltergeist cases and a lot of the lesser known ones, too.
Are most cases then kind of innocuous? In other words, I mean, yeah, it could be disturbing to see things, disembodied things moving around, things in your house, but are most of them pretty innocuous, just things moving around and it goes no further? Is that the most common? Is it more rare to have something that's maybe more malevolent, or is it the other way around?
It seemed more rare. I mean, most of them, I mean, a lot of them seemed like they were destructive. Like a lot of them would break things. I mean, you know, it would break people's windows, you know, it would, you know, it would mess up a bunch of their stuff, you know, break their furniture and stuff, which, you know, is bad enough. But it seemed like, you know, there were like a large amount of cases where people were hurt, but it seemed like it takes a lot for a poltergeist outbreak to get to that point, you know. But like I said, there were a few, particularly the ones that where it started fires. I mean, there were a couple of cases that, like there was one in Talladega, Alabama, I believe, and, you know, a couple other ones where people's houses burnt down. And one family actually had three houses burned down, you know, because it followed them from place to place. You know, I don't know. I feel like it probably is pretty rare for people to get seriously hurt by them. Like a lot of times people are, you know, bit or they're hit by flying objects or something, but they're not, you know, killed or anything. But, you know, I was surprised at how many cases there were where it did go a lot farther, you know, and people were actually injured or property was destroyed or things like that. But, you know, I'm not sure if it's just, it's hard for it to ramp up to that level. So most of the time it's just going to be stuff flying around and then it might get really bad, but, you know, it'll peter out after a while. But sometimes it'll just go all the way and, you know, kill a person, which did happen in a couple of the cases that I described in there.
What seems to bring a poltergeist on?
It seemed like, I mean, there are exceptions, but it seemed like in almost every case, particularly the ones where the manifestations were particularly violent, there is always some kind of emotional distress going on within the family unit. And it's usually a teenager. Not always, but I don't think it's very, very rare. There were a few cases that I researched for the book, but it seems very rare for just like a normal family with no problems or anything like that to suddenly have this stuff start happening. There's usually some kind of latent, you know, emotional trauma going on there among the family members. And one thing I found really interesting was that in most of the pyromaniac poltergeist cases where fires were started, it was almost always a teenage girl. Like I think in all but two of the cases, I think it was almost always a teenage girl. One, I think it was a 9-year-old boy. So I thought that was really interesting because it seemed like, I mean, teenage girls are usually the main focus anyway, but I thought it was strange how the manifestation of fire was seemed like a particular thing that like that's kind of how their emotional trauma came out, like as fire, you know, like as fire, like fire starter, you know. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But like I said, it's almost always adolescence. And, you know, that kind of raises the other question, too, because I think a lot of people think, oh, well, it's adolescence because they're playing tricks or they want attention or something like that. And in a couple of cases, it probably is that. But, you know, and I did in my book, I did, you know, say if one of the teenagers was caught like faking something, I did say that in the book. But that doesn't necessarily imply that the rest of the phenomena was faked, or because some of the stuff I don't think could have been faked by a teenager or by an adult, frankly.
But there are some hoaxes. You ran across some hoaxes in your work?
Oh, yeah. And I actually did include a few cases that I didn't really want to editorialize to the point where I said, well, I think this is fake, but I did pick some that otherwise, you know, that other researchers had said was fake, like the Cock Lane ghost, which they figured that was from the 1700s, and they figured that was a hoax. And, you know, Amityville Horror, which, you know, later on, like a lot of people said, yeah, they just made the story up. But I kind of wanted to include them, one, because they were well known, but also I kind of wanted to show a contrast between perhaps what a real poltergeist manifestation would look like versus what a faked one would look like, because sometimes there were differences. It seemed like, particularly in the case of the Amityville Horror, you could kind of tell that they wanted a sort of plot, or they wanted like a demonic possession sort of angle, you know, because of the murders that had taken place in the house there. And it seemed like most of the poltergeist cases that were probably genuine didn't really seem to have much of a plot. It was just kind of like a random outburst. Like it started suddenly, and it was just the things that it would do were very strange, and they didn't really make any sense, you know? So I kind of liked having those cases in there just as a kind of contrast with the ones that were probably more genuine.
It's such an amazing phenomena. You know, it's one thing to see a ghost, yet another thing to have something moving around. So that's why I'm so glad that we have you on the program today. We are going to be back with Jenny Ashford. We're going to talk about her new book, The Unseen Hand, and talk more about poltergeists right after this. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by Gaia, the streaming TV service dedicated to exploring the cutting edge of metaphysics, ancient wisdom, and the unexplained. And keep listening, because I'm going to tell you how you can get your first month for only 99 cents. Now, if you're not familiar with Gaia, let me explain to you what it is. Now, if any of you, and then most people by this time, are streaming a lot of television programming and movies, and they're on those big services that we've all kind of heard about. And those services are great, but if you look at them, you know, there might be here and there a documentary or something covering the unusual, the Fortean, but there's really nowhere in those areas can be found a central hub. But luckily, there is a streaming TV network that is specifically dedicated to the topics that we love, the paranormal, the strange, the Fortean, the metaphysical, and it is Gaia. And I've been telling you about it for the last few weeks, and you really need to check it out, because Gaia explores these topics that we love, and they're always providing viewers with tremendous new content, and this week is no exception. Now, for example, some of the shows, if you were a member of Gaia, that you could watch, The Acceleration of Time on Wisdom Teachings by David Wilcock. They examine the geometry at the infinitesimal and galactical levels of existence, and this research begins to pay off as they see how this energetic geometry affects the planets encircling the sun. How about this one? Antarctica, the new Area 51, that's on Cosmic Disclosure, and Corey Good brings forward new information coming out of Antarctica, revealing that it has become the new Area 51. George Norrie on his show, Beyond Belief, is going to talk to Jim Mars, who is fantastic, and he's going to talk about the history of the Illuminati. And there is so much more that you can enjoy. And it's kind of neat, because Gaia has set up a special page for us as listeners to the Paranormal Podcast, and you can get little samplings of different things. You can go over to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. And there you'll see a sampling and get to watch some clips, no charge, just to get a sense of what Gaia is all about. For example, I'm looking here, Nostradamus' prophecies for our time with John Hoag on Beyond Belief, or revealing the original secret space vehicles with Mark McCandlish. And that one has over 216,000 views. So check all that out over at Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim. And then once you've checked it out, I think you're going to say, you know, 99 cents for a month of this? I've got to try it. So go up to the top of that page at Gaia.com/Jim and click on the little orange sign up button in the upper right hand corner. And there you can sign up and give Gaia a try for only 99 cents for a month. It is a fantastic deal. And I think once you give it a try, you are going to love it. So go over to Gaia.com/Jim. That's Gaia.com/Jim to see what's happening on the largest consciousness media streaming platform in the world. Thanks, Gaia. We are back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Jenny Ashford. She has explored the area of poltergeists in her new book, The Unseen Hand, a new exploration of poltergeist phenomena. Now, obviously, Jenny, you're into this stuff. You've written multiple books about the supernatural. So you're familiar with poltergeist. And of course, we're all familiar with the popular culture and the entertainment that we see. What surprised you in your investigations?
Well, the first thing that surprised me was how many of these cases there were. Like I said, I had heard of, you know, Enfield, everyone's heard of that one, and Borley Rectory and things like that. But once you really start digging into this stuff, it's kind of everywhere and it's all over the world. I mean, I found, you know, cases from India. I found cases from, you know, Australia that had a whole bunch of them that I had never heard of. And some of them were quite extraordinary. So not only how widespread it is, but also how far back in history that it went and how similar the ones, you know, from history were to the modern day ones. Like it seems like, and that kind of makes me think that this probably, whatever is causing it, that it probably is a genuine phenomenon just because the similarities are so stark. And it seems like it's the same phenomenon. It hasn't really changed throughout history. It doesn't change across cultures. You know, it really gets reported as pretty much the same thing. So I think that was probably the most surprising thing that I encountered while I was researching it.
Now, in terms of what is behind it, I'd interviewed years ago, probably the most substantive interview I've done on this subject until now, with a gentleman by the name of Michael Clarkson up in Canada, who had written a pretty extensive book about poltergeists, and he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. So he wasn't coming from it as a supernatural guy, but as a hard-boiled journalist, and he ended up believing in it. Now, he tended to think that it was something that was emanating from, like you said, adolescents, teenagers. It's something that is somehow, and I hope that I'm saying this right because the interview is probably 7 or 8 years ago, but emanating from them and causing these things to happen. Not that they were faking it necessarily, but there was something unseen, an unseen hand, making this happen, emanating from them. What are your thoughts? What do you think is behind? Obviously, we have some of the hoaxes and some of the things that turned out not to be true. But what do you think are behind the genuine cases? Do you have any theories?
Oh, I definitely agree that poltergeist phenomena, I really do think it emanates from a living person unconsciously. I don't think they're consciously doing it.
Right.
And I actually came to this, I mean, as I said, and I've been on this show before, and I talked about my book, The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist, which was the first paranormal nonfiction that I wrote. And the subject of that book, you know, was a poltergeist focus. You know, it's, you know, my boyfriend, Tom Ross, and he's the one that kind of got me interested in this stuff. Now, he came to the belief, I mean, it happened to him when he was 13, but he came to the belief later that he's like, I think it was me doing it. I was doing it unconsciously because he was going through a lot of emotional stress at the time. And once he realized that it was him doing it, the phenomena stopped. Now, many years later, when he and I were working on another book, it actually, the phenomena restarted at our house, and I had never seen it before. You know, I had only known of it because of him describing it and other people describing it to me, but I had never seen anything like that. But it actually did start here. And that really kind of confirmed my belief that I think it's coming from him. Like, he doesn't do it consciously. He doesn't try to do it. It's just every now and then he'll get in a particular state of mind and something will happen. Something will move, or, you know, electronics will turn off and on with no one doing anything, you know, things of that nature. So I do think that there's some kind of, and I think it's rare. I mean, I think it takes like a particular kind of set of circumstances for it to happen. And I don't think it happens that often. But if there's kind of the perfect storm of someone who's under a lot of emotional stress and can't release it somehow, I think it's almost, I think it's some principle that we probably don't understand. I think that it's almost like an emotional release that's coming out in some other way and affecting the outside environment, you know, whether it's some kind of unknown quantum mechanics or whether, you know, who knows. But I definitely do think so. So in that sense, I don't think it's supernatural, quote unquote. I just think it's some kind of scientific principle that we don't really understand yet, that we can somehow affect matter outside of us, but we can't do it consciously. Like, it's almost like it has to be allowed to happen, and it doesn't happen very often. But I really do think that that's probably what's causing it.
One thing I think that people worry about, if they play with a Ouija board or they do various incantations or anything like that, that it might invite something like this in. Did you find any proof whatsoever for those concerns?
I didn't really see anything where that had happened. There were a few cases where, you know, there was the case that that was just called Julia from 2008. And that woman had some kind of poltergeist activity that manifested as demonic possession. And she said that she had been involved in the occult when she was younger. But, there was only her say-so. And I don't know. I think that people that are interested in the occult, maybe, I don't know if they're necessarily inviting, you know, like another being, as much as they're maybe interpreting some kind of paranormal activity as an outside force. Because, and that's why the final section of my book, I put a lot of cases that are normally considered, you know, demonic possession cases, you know, like Roland Doe, who the movie The Exorcist was based on, and things like that. Because I don't think that it's necessarily an outside force. I don't think it's a demon. I don't even really think it's any kind of outside spirit. But I do think that it seems to me that people's belief and expectation about how it's going to manifest itself, if they believe that this is a demon afflicting them, then that is how it will act, because that's what they're expecting. And because I think that they're doing it unconsciously. So unconsciously, they're making a demon or a spirit or some kind of thing because that's what they're expecting. I think it's almost kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in that way. But, obviously I could be wrong. It could be, you know, an outside spirit. It could be a demon, could be an elemental spirit, which I think is kind of a well-known thing, because I do think that people make a distinction between ghost and poltergeist. You know, there is a lot of gray area there, it seems like, but I don't necessarily think it's an outside being. I think it's a person making a being and perceiving it as an outside being.
Do you have a favorite story or episode or two, a couple that have really stuck with you in writing this book, The Unseen Hand?
Oh gosh, there were so many. Probably my favorite case, if you can call it that, but, I think probably my favorite one was the one of Doris Bither, which the entity was based on. Now, she certainly did believe that there were outside spirits haunting her. I think, but she believed that at least one of them was a ghost, because I believe there were four that she perceived in her house. Now, she was the one that was, you know, sexually assaulted, or claimed to be sexually assaulted by the spirits. But the interesting thing about that case was that, you know, it was pretty thoroughly investigated by parapsychologists, you know, Barry Taff and some of the other people at the parapsychology laboratory. And they saw a bunch of really strange things, like a bunch of very strange light anomalies that looked like heads and shoulders of people. And they took a lot of photographs of some really strange, you know, light things that could have been some kind of energy or some kind of outside being. I don't know how much of the sexual assault was because, I mean, the parapsychologist never saw that, but they did see a lot of strange things. They heard a lot of noises that they couldn't explain, and saw a lot of light anomalies that they couldn't explain. But it is interesting too, that even though Doris Bither was much older than a traditional poltergeist focus, there was a lot of psychological tension and a lot of psychological trauma going on in the house between, I mean, she had just gone through this really terrible divorce, and she had four children, and she had kind of a contentious relationship with them. And there was like a lot of strange psychological things going on. And I do kind of think that that manifested in the particular way that it manifested. Like, I don't necessarily think that it was outside beings or ghosts or anything tormenting her. I think it was her doing it without her being aware of it. But that's probably the most interesting case to me. And I've done a podcast episode on it, and And I've done a lot of reading about it too, but that's probably my favorite case in the book.
Why do you think that this has captured people's imagination so greatly? Why they're so interested in Poltergeist?
You know, it's I don't know. And like one of the things I always thought was interesting about it, because like, I mean, I've always been interested in ghost stories and things like that, but I could never go the entire way with like thinking that people survived after death and you could see them after they died and they could talk to you and interact with you and things like that. But the interesting thing about Poltergeist is that it almost behaves the way a ghost would behave, but it seems like it's just possible, like just scientifically possible that it could be a real thing, and it's almost because it kind of suggests that humans have a lot of these latent kind of powers like within their brain and stuff like that, that we haven't really tapped into. And I think maybe that might kind of contribute too, because people could think, wow, if we could harness whatever it is that it's doing, it's like we could move things without touching them and things like that. So maybe that's what it is. It's almost kind of like scary, but it's scientifically plausible. You know, maybe the same reason that, you know, things like UFOs and aliens are really fascinating to people, because it seems, you know, paranormal and out there and stuff like that, but it's also plausible. Like it could happen. It wouldn't be, you know, totally crazy for it to happen. So I think Poltergeist is probably the same, you know, the same type of thing as that.
Now, we talked about pyromaniac poltergeist, this idea of fire starting and so forth. Another one you cover here is blood. I mean, tell us about that's wild, when just blood shows up. What kind of things have you seen in that arena?
Yeah, that's actually a very rare thing. It's actually more common for what they call poltergeist flows, you know, is usually water or some kind of oil or, you know, wax or something like that. But there were a handful of cases, only two or three cases, where unusually there was just blood all of a sudden. Probably the best known one was the Atlanta Blood House. And that actually happened in the home, and it was fairly recent, but it actually happened in the home of an elderly couple. And they had lived in this house for, you know, 20 odd years, I believe. And they had really never had any paranormal things happen there before. But all of a sudden, you know, the old woman gets out of the shower one night and there's a huge puddle of blood on the bathroom floor. And, you know, at first she thinks something's happened to her husband. He's hurt or something like that. So she calls him and he comes in and he's fine. And, you know, he's all clean and everything. And they start walking around the house and there's just blood everywhere. It's just there's puddles of it. It's like underneath the appliances and things like that. And they ended up having to call the police. And the police, you know, at first they thought, well, maybe some animal got in here and bled it, but they couldn't find anything. And it was just so weird and like so random to just have all this blood. And they actually, they typed the blood. And it was human, but it was a different blood type to the two people that lived there. And for a while, they had to close the house off, like as a crime scene, because they weren't sure if a murder had taken place there, because, you know, there was some strange person's blood in these people's house. But, you know, after a while, they couldn't find anything. And, you know, they still have no idea where that blood come from or why it just appeared there. Or it was just very, very weird. And like a lot of the blood even appeared in, you know, in strange places. It was kind of all over the house and it was under things, like somewhere where it wouldn't have got to, like by natural means.
Another one that fascinates me is this idea of electrical anomalies. What did you find there?
Probably the most famous aspect of that was the Rosenheim case, where that girl, that Anne Marie girl, started working in a law office. And then all of a sudden, you know, lights started flickering off and on and the telephone started going crazy and things like that. And there really does seem to be, and like I said, I think this is why I kind of tend toward the idea that poltergeists are caused by some kind of energy, some kind of electrical energy or some kind of, you know, electrical field like put off by a person, because it seems to be a really common aspect of poltergeist outbreaks, even ones that, you know, have other things going on, where electrical devices will either, you know, flicker off and on, or they will not work. And that happens a lot with a lot of paranormal investigators. You know, parapsychologists will go and investigate a case. They'll find that their equipment won't work while they're in the house, and then it will work fine later on. You know, and there's always these kind of, and there were actually a couple cases that I put in there that were pretty much all electrical, and like, you know, they would buy a new toaster and it would stop working. They would buy another one, it would stop working. And, you know, and, or they would just go on the fritz. And actually there was one, there was this one really strange case where the main manifestation of the phenomena was blue flame shooting out of the electrical outlets and setting things on fire. And this happened over and over and over again. And eventually the family ended up having to move out and have the house torn down so they could collect on the insurance money. But, you know, something like that with just these flames shooting out of it. And they had the house rewired twice. And, you know, that kind of thing, there's just no way that someone could fake that. I mean, that had to be some kind of, they could, you know, they had electricians in there. They could find nothing that could be causing that bizarre, you know, this bizarre thing of like all this just coming out of the outlets. And the outlets still worked. It's, you know, so it wasn't like they were broken, but the outlets still worked. It's just flames shooting out, setting the furniture on fire and things like that. Yeah, that was one of the weirdest ones in the book.
Well, I've got to say, I think, like you mentioned, I think this is one of the more plausible things in the paranormal. As incredible as it seems like something really is going on. And I would say if you are interested in poltergeists, that you should pick up The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. Jenny, where can we find the book and more information about everything you do?
Well, gosh, the easiest way is just go right to Amazon and do a search on The Unseen Hand, or do a search on my name, Jenny Ashford. I have an author page, and all my books are there. Unseen Hand is actually, it's in print, it's an ebook, and there's also an audiobook if you prefer that. Also, I have a website. It's just www.jennyashford.com, and that pretty much has links to all my books and everything else that I do. And also, if you like podcasts, I do a podcast with Tom Ross called 13 O'Clock. And we talk about paranormal stuff. And then we do other things too, just general weird things, true crime, that kind of stuff. And we have a new episode every Tuesday.
Well, our guest has been Jenny Ashford. The new book is The Unseen Hand, A New Exploration of Poltergeist Phenomena. I think you should pick it up. Jenny, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I certainly enjoyed that conversation with Jenny, and that was very, very interesting. And we thank her for her time. And check out that book, The Unseen Hand. And now we're going to talk about something very poignant, very touching. We've had Dr. Joe Gallenberger on the show several times, almost a very interesting guest, but this is a very different topic. But I think you'll find this discussion enlightening. And here it is. Our guest today is Dr. Joe Gallenberger, and we've had him on the programs before, and we've talked about some topics, including things like inner Vegas and liquid luck. And it's always very enjoyable when we have him on, very insightful and interesting things he has to say. But today we're going to talk about something totally different, quite a departure from those titles. It's called Heaven is for Healing, A Soul's Journey After Suicide. And it's about his brother who committed suicide. And he's going to talk about him and some of the things that have occurred over the 20-year span since his passing. Dr. Joe Gallenberger is a clinical psychologist with 30 years of experience. He is an in-demand, internationally known as a psychokinesis and manifestation workshop provider. He's a senior trainer at the Monroe Institute and created its highly successful MC Square program. He developed Sync Creation, a home study course in manifestation, and has taught over 70 Inner Vegas Adventure workshops. His books include Inner Vegas, Creating Miracles, Abundance, and Health, and Liquid Luck, The Good Fortune Handbook, and they've received rave reviews. He resides in North Carolina. Dr. Gallenberger, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on, and it's a pleasure to be with you again, Jim.
So when we're talking about this situation, I know this is a follow-up to an earlier book you did, so there's some history to this if somebody's coming to this story now. Can you tell us about your brother Peter and what happened?
Sure. My brother Pete was 8 years older than me in a family of five, so he ended up with quite a few of the parenting chores on me, including changing my diapers, if you will. And as we grew up together, he was one of my mentors. He was a handsome, energetic, honest, hardworking guy. And so I really looked up to him. But he had a glitch where any kind of job he got, the timing was off. Like he would arrange to sell the big RV units and then there'd be a gas crunch, those kind of things. So he had trouble keeping a steady job there and ran into financial problem and then physical health and pain issues after a car accident. So as an adult, I had him come and live in the upstairs floor of my psychotherapy office, and we became really much closer and best friends. It wasn't working in my town, so he went out to Las Vegas because it was booming at that time to look for work. He didn't realize that they won't hire anybody even in a 7-Eleven out there if you have a bankruptcy. And so he wasn't able to find work there. And then I did get a call from Las Vegas police that he had shot himself. And I had to tell my family. And it sort of rocked our family's world a good bit. Jim, with my meditation experience and teaching up at Monroe Institute, we have the states there with special brainwave technology, getting people to meditate deeply. And with that, one of their programs called Lifeline is to contact people on the other side, particularly when they're in transition from this life to spirit. And so I use some of my Lifeline skills to connect with him. I also connected with a channeler, a woman that I think is one of the best in the world that I really respect. And she had many sessions with Pete on the other side. So Brothers Forever was the first book that came out a year or two after his death and talks about going through grief in an enlightened way, how you get through grief on something like this, and also his initial experience there. Heaven is for Healing, my new book, picks up because I was sitting there realizing it changed my whole life, my experience with him. I began to work to try to figure out how good people could have things not go well and how you could create a really wonderful life. So most of my efforts in the last two decades have been on this area of manifesting. And so I realized, boy, it really changed me. I wonder what he's been doing the last 20 years. So we began to have connection through the channeler again and my own meditations to see what he's been doing on the other side. And that turned out to be very interesting. The first session we had, the amount of compassion, this was on the phone. The channeler was in New Mexico. I was in North Carolina. The energy was so great, I couldn't even sit down. And we were streaming tears, both me and the woman who was getting the information, as waves of compassion from the other side came toward the family of suicide and as well as the person who suicided. And they talked a lot about the process over there, almost like a medical triage when somebody comes to the other side in crisis, how they handle that. And so Pete's been now doing quite well and, in fact, is about ready to choose another life, if you will. Come back in incarnational space. So that's the short version.
Well, a couple of things I want to cover quickly that may be not really beyond the scope, but aside from his experience, I just want to say, and I think this is important, and obviously you thought it was very important as well. If anybody is in a tough situation where they are contemplating suicide, you pointed to some resources that they can go to, because most importantly, we want everybody to stay safe and healthy. And there are some great resources out there if people find themselves at wit's end and they're contemplating something like that, aren't there?
Yes. In the very first couple pages of the book, which if you look on Amazon, you know, it would come up and you could read them. There are a couple suicide prevention lines, if you will. And I called each one of those personally, and somebody answered on the first ring, and they're very caring and they were very competent. So there's help available that way as well as through your local communities. And I would say that suicide is not a good solution. It devastates anybody here, people that you may not even think you've affected in your life. When Pete died, we got letters from bank tellers, grocery store clerks, just how much he meant to them because he was nice to them as he would check out or use their business. So for the person, it doesn't solve anything, though you're met with compassion over there. You still have to face your issues. And for the people left here, it's one of the most devastating kind of losses. So we are definitely not promoting somebody to take that as an option.
Right. We wanted to make sure people knew that. And actually, the one you list out here, I'll just read the one: National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 1-800-273-8255. Again, that's 1-800-273-8255. Now, I wanted to ask you about something you just kind of mentioned there. The grief of those left behind. I've been fortunate in my life thus far, and no one that I've personally been close to has committed suicide, and God forbid that happen, but it can happen at any time. And sometimes there may not be a lot of signs. Talk to us a little bit about that grief of the survivors. If there's anything that you gleaned from your communications with Peter on that, and just your thoughts on the grief of those left behind.
Sure. Any sudden death is a shock, of course. And but with suicide, there's a lot of what I would call woulda, coulda, shoulda. The family and friends go into agony about what could we have done differently, feeling, you know, guilt about that, uncertainty about that. With Pete, I'm a clinical psychologist. We tried everything. But you still, those questions come up. It's also a very isolating event that many friends and associates don't know what to say, so they pull back. And in fact, the family of the suicide person can be in such shock and grief that they pull back. I remember at Pete's funeral, at the end of the service, we walked out of the front and didn't even turn around. And there were hundreds of people in the back of the church who were willing to try to console us, but we didn't even see them. We just walked out in shock. So that's one thing that's complicates the grief is all this second guessing. And the thing with most loss is humans tend to try to close their heart off to protect themselves from any further hurt. And that closing off of your heart really is one of the things that causes so much grief and feeling dead inside and those kind of things. So, in fact, with the new book, Healing, Evidence for Healing, I developed a CD exercise called Ocean Heart for people to listen to if they've ever had deep heartbreak or loss, to allow that heart to be open again. Because if you can do that, then you can move through the grief more easily.
Now, Peter, on the other side, what did he tell you about the early years of his experience? What happened when he passed? And maybe we can take it kind of chronologically.
Yes. Well, within 24 hours of his death, we were in contact. And the first thing he sent was like a road sign. And it had a gavel, a judge's gavel, and a big line through it. And the message really strong: there is no judgment. And he was so relieved about that. We were raised Catholic to think that if you suicided, you go to burning hell for all eternity. And that's one of the big reasons I wrote the book, because my mom's agony about losing a child was compounded by the thought that he'd be in hell for all eternity, for example. But he got there, and his energy was scattered, and he said, boy, that's not the way to go. His sense of humor was still there. And then they seemed to put him in a very long rest state. As he came out of that, he could kind of go, oh, now knowing what I know from the other side perspective, I could do much better than I did. And he was eager to come back into a physical life. And they said, hold it, wait. We really advise you to just observe for many years and see how other people handle the challenges of being in the physical. So he did that. So that period, you should say, him observing here and experiencing kind of classrooms over there to learn more about feminine energy, which he didn't understand very well, things like surrender, letting go, and trust, and eventually kind of getting educated into what he might need to do well here on the planet. They mentioned quite an array of services for people who suicide, because there's quite an array of suicides, from 2 weeks to live with terminal cancer pain, which is kind of no big deal in some ways, to murder suicide, where a person creates tremendous turmoil as they leave. So they seem to have methods to address whatever the soul had been through. And the more rough the experience, the more long they might be in what we might call a induced coma, where they can work on them on an unconscious level with healing. But he came out pretty quickly into conscious experience. And the latest has been that he's ready for another life, and they have deep respect for your own choice. Presented many options, such as the life as a woman with a physical injury, who then can become a good healer, a life where a brother in his family dies young, and he's forced to stay to take care of the rest of the family, so it would teach him endurance. But the big surprise to me, Jim, was that also an option is non-physical lives that you could look at as like very vivid dreams. The person would say, yes, I got born and I had a girlfriend and this and that happened, but they stay more in touch with spirit, and the problems or challenges are not as hard encoded. When you're in a physical life, that seems to be encoded into your very DNA and into your family's DNA and cultural structure that you're here to work on. So it's an easier thing to get through, this simulation life, if you will. And because time is irrelevant over there, it's pretty efficient. You can do several of those in the time you would have a life here on Earth. So, in fact, it looks like Pete may be choosing a non-physical life next. And they say that's quite common for people who have had a real hard time on Earth because they're reluctant to come back. You know, they remember all the pain. And it's so pretty and beautiful over there, if you will. So it looks like they set up several non-physical scenarios, and he is choosing one that he thinks will teach him a lot, and yet he'll be able to accomplish successfully, if you will, and kind of Olympic training for another physical life here on Earth, if you will.
Our guest is Dr. Joe Gallenberger. The book is Heaven is for Healing, A Soul's Journey After Suicide. We'll be back right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. The Paranormal Podcast is brought to you by the Mysteries Cruise. Join me, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and Micah Hanks for paranormal fun on the high seas. I think you're absolutely going to love it in November, November 8th through the 13th, to be exact, 2017. We're going to go on the Crown Princess of the Princess Line, so you know it's a fine ship. And the three of us are going to have a lot of paranormal fun with hopefully you. We've had quite a few people sign up already. And the thing that I love about it is we're going to have the fun of a traditional cruise, which is, I've been on a cruise. It is the best vacation I've had, bar none. You really, truly get to unplug. You're going to have that. You have all that fun. And then you're going to layer over it paranormal presentations and discussions with me and Micah and Rosemary about these topics. I think it's going to be great. In fact, we're going to be doing a campfire live where you can tell your paranormal stories. We'll be playing some clips from that show and having an altogether good time. Now, a little bit about the destination. We're going to depart from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and we're going to go to Grand Turk, Turks, and Caicos. We're going to have the Gibbs Key Stingray encounter included, and we're going to have excursions that the speakers are going to join you on. And I just think it's going to be a great time. Now, this is run by a company called Holiday Maker Travel. Mike and Wendy over there, really good people and people I really trust and enjoy working with. We worked with them on other things in the past. Micah, for example, has gone on cruises with them in the past and just raves about them. Great people. And you can get more information about this fantastic cruise at mysteriescruise.com. That's MYSTERIES cruise.com. And then in addition, you could call Mike or Wendy at 877-642-4308. That's 877-642-4308. And if you use the promo code in the month of May of J-H-M-A-Y, that's J-H-M-A-Y, you will get one of my campfire books, your choice, autographed. So I think that's a pretty cool deal. I think you will really enjoy this. Think about true relaxation, but then again, think about all of the fun you'll have exploring these paranormal topics. Another cool thing, and I'm excited about this, we as speakers get to rotate among different tables for dinner every night. So you'll have the opportunity to have dinner with us and talk to us about these topics that we love. And they're, of course, going to be the paranormal topics, because that's what we love. We love the paranormal talk. And I'm just honored to be included with Rosemary and Micah. They are both fantastic. And hopefully I bring a little bit to the table, too. And we're looking forward to it. That is MysteriesCruise.com. That's MysteriesCruise.com. Also, you can call Mike and Wendy at Holidaymaker Travel at 877-642-4308. That's 877-642-4308 if you have any questions or just want to chat about the cruise. We thank you so much, and we hope to sail away with you. Thanks, Holidaymaker Travel. We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Joe Gallenberger. Today we're talking about his new book, Heaven is for Healing, A Soul's Journey After Suicide. And we're talking about his brother, Peter, who committed suicide, and the communication from the other side that Dr. Gallenberger has had with him since his passing. Now, Dr. Gallenberger, forgive me, but some people may say, well, Dr. Gallenberger is very well-meaning, but he's lost someone very close to him, and he's possibly deluded himself to think that he's communicating with his brother, that he means well, but this may be all a figment of his imagination. I'm guessing there may be some people out there saying that. What would you say to him?
Well, Jim, I would ask for an open-mindedness. On the channeler I mentioned, the first session I had with her, all I said is, tell me the most important message in my life. We were by the phone. She had no visual cues. This is way before Google. This is, 30 years ago. And she nailed me and my issues. The next thing she did is tell me gold would go up, I think, 14 days, maybe it was 17 days straight. And had never done that in the history that I could see of the metal. And it indeed did that. And then she gave me the name of two stocks that would be good that year, and they ended up the best two on the exchange for the year. So I was getting some information that was kind of verifiable, if you will. In terms of the Monroe Lifeline program I mentioned, Institute, they've actually done TV shows on the program called Lifeline, where then they did research back, even going back into the 1800s, with consciousnesses they had been in communication with on this soul level, and got good verification that these people indeed existed as reported by the meditator. So I got a little bit of stuff. I am scientifically bent, if you will. So in my psychokinesis work, it's backed by decades of research in various universities, labs, things like that. And so I just say, see if it rings true, and also check out the data.
Fair enough. I felt I had to ask that because there may be some people out there with that kind of thought. Now, this has changed your life as well. I mean, it's really informed the direction that you've taken your work. Talk to us about that, because I think that's very interesting, and a case where, you've taken a very sad situation and made something positive of it.
Yes. So again, with him being honest, hardworking, and all of that, and having such bad luck, quote, we looked at it, and it seemed like he was suspicious of having any personal power. He did not feel deserving of goodness, and he would usually choose fear over love. And I have a phrase on my desk here that I made up. It says, fear is expensive, love is priceless, choose wisely. So my work is around getting people to be able to reduce their fears and increase their lovingness and expand their beliefs about what's possible in their lives, about what they could create and manifest. And that's in the effort for all of us to live to more of our full potential. And a natural result of that is to be much happier, fulfilled with feelings of meaning, which is a great antidote to the suicide thing. And so it did push me in that direction. And I found that quite satisfying. I enjoyed my psychotherapy work. I did 30 years as a therapist. But this area of manifesting and helping people create good, better realities has been a real kick to do for the last decade.
Peter, in his experience over there, you explained some of it, but there's some thoughts, about the afterlife, you know, what we expect. And you talked about the guidance that he received and so forth. But there's some kind of archetypes and certain touchstones, the tunnel of light, the all-encompassing love, being reunited with loved ones who have passed before, some of these things that we hear about the afterlife. Did those ring true to him?
I think I didn't ask him about the tunnel. I've had two near-death experiences for myself, motorcycle accident and an anaphylaxis reaction to bee sting. The idea of this surrounded by love, definitely. But within this, I would say, Jim, if the person is feeling after suicide such guilt or such anger or what depression, they may not be able to perceive some of what's available to them.
I see.
For a while. So we can create our own hellish thought form, if you will, for a while. But I really want to emphasize that all death leads to light. There is no eternal damnation. It's one of the main reasons I'm writing the book, because that's deeply set within our culture. In Roman times, in the Middle Ages, they would take all the family's property away, sometimes imprison the entire family of a suicide. In New Orleans, a couple hundred years ago, they would take the body, torture it, and then cut it into pieces and throw it to the alligators, because that was unconsecrated ground, and then demons could torture that soul for eternity. So we've had a very heavy feeling about suicide, and that increases the grief hundredfold to the people remaining behind. And if a person leaves by any means, including suicide, thinking there could be very heavy judgment, it can govern their other life experience, at least initially, until they are able to be reachable, if you will.
There's some sections here that I want to ask you about, because I think they're very interesting. This idea of no life wasted. What does that mean, no life wasted?
First of all, we cannot consciously judge what's going on. Well, Pete came into his life, best we can tell, feeling very much doubtful that love even existed. And he left this life knowing love did exist and it was real. That's a great victory. But from our point of view, his life looked like a failure, okay, in some ways. You know, people knew him, even with his act at the end, were very graced by his presence in life. But from his point of view, he felt like the life was a total failure until he got the bigger perspective. So that seems to be true. We don't really know what the heck is going on while we're here. Second is every drop of experience, once we get some perspective, it is valuable and is treasured, and we can learn from it. So that, say you had a life being a real SOB, and as you left the life, you got aware of how that affected other people, what you missed out on, etc. You may learn that, I'd like to be a kinder person next time, but I don't want to feel vulnerable or weak. And then you would learn how to be open but not be so weak in your opinion. So whatever's going on, it seems like we learn.
And I'm interested where the CD comes into play. And I've listened to some of your other CDs. I think they're really, really interesting, and I actually enjoy listening to them. Tell us about this particular CD that's kind of a companion to this book.
Yes. Well, after Pete died, it felt like my heart was broken, and I pulled back from other people, not wanting to be hurt, and then I did not want to live that way. I had a young daughter and family and stuff that I wanted to be open to be with and loving with. And so I ended up with an image of changing this idea of broken heart. It's kind of a myth. Our heart doesn't break. It just keeps beating. Into our heart as being like a vast ocean of love. And so, Jim, if you came into my life, it'd be like putting your hand in water. You'd be surrounded by my love completely without resistance. And if you left, the water would go back to complete, like taking a hand out of water and perhaps losing a drop. So I use that image in the meditation, and it goes through how to open your heart, helps the person do that with some very advanced brainwave technology. Then to bring into your heart all your experiences that you love, and people and places and pets, etc. And then with this vast open heart feeling going on, then to look at things in your life that have caused heartbreak or where you felt betrayal, and be able to hold those with a different energy. And in fact, we found it also very useful to handle all the stress in the culture right now, say in politics, etc., trouble in the Middle East. You can look at those things and remain compassionate but feel strong and peaceful. So we think it's a very powerful meditation. It's only been out a few weeks, but the reports are incredible that people are finding it very, very healing. And every time I've listened to it, memories have come back from my childhood, 10 years old, etc., that I've forgotten and haven't thought of in 20 years that are wonderful memories of loving times. So I think it's pretty cool and hope people will give it a try. It's available download and CD, and right directly would be oceanheartcd.com would take you to the place to get it.
And we certainly want to let everybody know exactly where they can go to get the book and connect with everything else you do. But first, do you have any final thoughts for us in regard to Heaven is for Healing and your experience with your brother Peter in this regard?
Well, it was a difficult book to even think about writing, and I did not want to encourage suicide, as we've mentioned. But I felt it was so important because it is now affecting so many people. I felt it would be good for the whole culture to lighten up their feelings about suicide, and to how it paradoxically that could be more communication about it, more help for people thinking that. And I would say, there's always hope. We often say, while you're alive, there's always hope. But it extends even beyond that. We do live in a compassionate universe. So whatever mess a person has created or feels they're in, or lack of resource they feel they have, reach out, open your heart. There's ways to do that. And I see miracles every day, and I hear reports of miracles every day where I had myself personally about 35 years of depression that runs in my family, and now I'm one happy camper for the next 20 or 30. So don't give up.
Great words of wisdom. Never give up. Dr. Gallenberger, where can people find this book and connect also with everything else you do?
Sure. So Heaven is for Healing is on Amazon and in bookstores and stuff, Barnes & Noble, etc. You can also go to my website, heavenisforhealing.com, and you'll be sent a signed copy. And the heavenisforhealing.com also is where you can get the CD called Ocean Heart and see my other offerings.
Dr. Joe Gallenberger, thank you for joining us today.
Jim, it was my pleasure. I hope it helps a lot of folks.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast. I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that you will rate, review, and subscribe to the show, particularly our friends who listen on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. And it really means a lot to us and keeps us high on the charts. You know, these days we have all this competition from these big companies, and we are decidedly not a big company, but we have you, and we believe that you'll keep us at the top of the charts, and you can do that by subscribing and rating and reviewing. We thank you so much. We'll talk to you again on the Paranormal Podcast. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.